Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Good afternoon. Please be seated. I would like to begin by saying that yesterday's announcement that OPEC members will increase oil production is good news for our economy and for the American consumer. These increases should bring lower prices, which will help to sustain economic growth here in America, and also, and very importantly, throughout the world. It will also, I hope, bring relief to hard-pressed truckers in this country who have been especially hard hit, and others who have high fuel costs, by providing a greater balance between oil production and consumption. While home heating costs and the price at the pump are both expected to fall in the next few weeks, I urge the oil companies to do everything they can to bring the savings to consumers as quickly as possible. Meanwhile, we will continue to monitor developments in world markets closely. Since January, our administration has taken significant action to address high oil prices, from helping more low-income and elderly citizens to pay their heating bills, to calling for the creation of a regional market reserve in the Northeast, to asking Congress to immediately reauthorize the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. It is also very, very important for Congress now to act on my proposal to strengthen our long-term energy security, including new tax incentives and investments to support domestic oil producers and to promote the development and use of alternative fuels and more efficient energy technologies. We can become much more energy efficient and support economic development if we do. Congress also has an opportunity and a responsibility to make progress on a number of other important issues for the American people this year. First, we must work together to reduce the staggering toll of gun violence in America, by passing my proposal for more prosecutors and stronger gun enforcement, and by finally passing a strong juvenile justice bill that closes the gun show loophole, requires child safety locks for all handguns, and bans the importation of large capacity ammunition clips. For 9 months now, key congressional Republicans, egged on by the NRA, have stood on a bill and stopped it from being considered by keeping it from coming out of conference onto the floor of both houses for a vote. 14 days ago, a House resolution passed with bipartisan support, sponsored by Representative Zoloftrin of California. It simply said that House and Senate conferees should meet to settle their differences on the bill that has been languishing in Congress for too long. But after 14 days, the response to Representative Loftrin's resolution has been deafening silence and still no action. It appears the opponents of reform have run out of arguments, so now they're just trying to run out the clock. This makes no sense. With crime at a 25-year low and the Brady Law keeping guns out of the hands of half millions of felons, fugitives, and stalkers, the argument is over. Gun safety measures do work and do not interfere with the interests of ordinary hunters and sports people. So it's time to build on our proven success and pass this common sense legislation. 3 weeks ago, I asked Congress to finish the gun bill and send it to me by the anniversary of the Columbine tragedy, April 20th. That deadline can still be met. So again, for the sake of our children, I ask Congress to stop the delay. This should not be a partisan issue, and it should lead to action, not argument. There are some other issues I'd like to mention briefly. First, to make sure the benefits of Medicare keep pace with the benefits of modern medicine, we must reform Medicare and add a voluntary prescription drug benefit. 3 out of 5 older Americans lack dependable, affordable drug coverage. Since I first raised the issue last year, virtually every member of Congress has voiced support for some kind of new prescription drug benefit. I call on Congress to pass a bill that ensures all Medicare beneficiaries the option to choose an affordable, accessible drug benefit. If they do, of course, I will sign it. Second, to protect the interests of 190 million Americans in health plans, we should pass a strong, enforceable, bipartisan Patients' Bill of Rights. This isn't a partisan issue in America. The House has already passed a strong bill, but the insurance lobby continues to oppose it. All we need is for the Conference of Senators and Representatives to let every member in both houses vote his or her conscience on a real patient's bill of rights. If it passes, and it will, I will certainly sign it. Third, we should raise the minimum wage by a dollar over 2 years. A bipartisan majority in the House voted to do so earlier this month, but Republican leaders held the pay raise hostage for tax increases for the wealthiest Americans, tax breaks that can make it impossible to pay down the debt or strengthen Social Security and Medicare. I ask again to the Congress, do the right thing. Everyone knows we need to raise the minimum wage. Send me a clean bill that raises the minimum wage by a dollar over 2 years, and I will sign it. Fourth, we must keep the economy growing. First, by opening new markets here at home in our hardest-pressed communities, rural and urban. And second, by opening new markets for American products and services around the world. Especially, we need to give our businesses, farmers, and workers access to the world's largest consumer market in China. There is no more important long-term international economic or national security issue facing us today. Congress should pass permanent normal trade relations with China this spring. I will say again, this requires us to take no further action on our part to lower tariffs or open markets. All the concessions are being made by China in return for entering an open trading system. If we do not do this, then the full benefits of all we negotiated will flow to all the other countries in the WTO, but not to the United States. The economic consequences will be bad. The national security consequences will be worse. Fifth, we must invest more in our public schools and demand more from them. I ask again Congress to endorse the principles in the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which call for ending social promotion and funding only those things which work to raise student achievement. And we know that our students can't learn in schools that are falling apart. Yesterday, a bipartisan school construction bill was introduced in the House that would provide $24.8 billion in tax credit bonds to modernize up to 6,000 of our schools. If the Republican leadership doesn't prevent it, Congress could vote on this proposal tomorrow. I ask the Congress to pass this bipartisan legislation, and I will sign it. Sixth, to save the lives of thousands of young people who every year get hooked on cigarettes, we must now pass legislation allowing the Food and Drug Administration to require tobacco, like the dangerous substance it is, to be regulated by the FDA. There is strong bipartisan support for this idea, and I hope the Congress will pass it. If they do, I will certainly sign it. Finally, I would like to say a few words about the importance of passing the supplemental budget request without delay. This is urgent funding for pressing needs at home and abroad, to help the families that were victims of Hurricane Floyd, to provide needed energy assistance for families struggling to cope with rising oil prices, to help keep illegal drugs out of our nation by supporting the Colombian government's courageous fight against drug traffickers, to keep the peace, provide for our troops, and build stability in Kosovo, and to provide needed debt relief to the world's poorest nations. When Congress adjourns this summer, we ought to be able to look back and say we took real steps to make America better. The issues have been decided. They are clearly there. They have also been debated. The American people want action, and they deserve it. The only thing left is for the congressional leadership to reach across party lines and to work with us to break the grip of special interests and do the people's business. Thank you very much.
President, you said that Assad's, that the ball is in Assad's court. Is that because you think that his insistence on the return of all Syrian land under occupation in exchange for peace lacks logic or possibility?
It's because he now knows in great detail what the Israeli proposals were, and I believe since they have made an effort to be specific and comprehensive, if we're going to make progress, they should now be able to know what his specific and comprehensive response is on all the issues. There's more than one issue here. And if we're going to have a negotiation, I don't think it's enough to say I don't like your position. Come back and see me when I like your position. And I understand how strongly he feels about it, but if he disagrees with their territorial proposal, which is quite significant, then there should be some other proposal, I think, coming from the Syrians about how their concerns could be handled. And that's what I meant by that. I did my best to try to just present what I thought the options were. And if we're going to have a negotiation, it takes two people coming up with ideas, or three sides in this case, if we're being asked to mediate it. He obviously has the perfect right to take whatever position he believes is in Syria's interests and whatever he thinks is right. But if there is a genuine desire for peace here on both sides, and I believe there is, and if both sides face certain significant political constraints within their countries, and I believe they do, then they both need to come up with some ideas and start talking. I mean, the one thing that there should be no doubt about is that there is a real effort being made here to resolve this. And I think it's clear that Prime Minister Barak would like to resolve it. And I think President Assad would like to resolve it. So once you know what the other side wants and you don't think you can do it, then you ought to come up with some alternative way of trying to respond to the underlying concerns that are behind the position. That's what I suggested, and I hope that will happen. And meanwhile, the rest of us will keep working. I had a good talk with President Mubarak yesterday about that, and I hope we can continue to move forward. Yes, you go next. And then I'll call you next.
Mr. President, three unarmed black men have been shot and killed by police in New York City in the past 13 months. Do you believe that the New York Police Department has a racial problem? And does that department require Justice Department oversight?
Well, I believe there is a Justice Department review of the practices in the department, which I think has been a matter of public record for some time. And in the Diallo case, there was a specific reference to a review of the action there for possible civil rights violations. And I think the important thing I'd like to say is, first of all, there's a lot of evidence that in city after city where the crime rate has dropped, and the crime rate's gone down a lot in New York, it's gone down a lot in every major city in America, and there is now ample evidence that the crime rate can go down and the tenor of community police relations can go up. And it's largely a matter of the right sort of training, the right sort of policies, and consistent effort there. So on the specific cases, I think I should say no more than, particularly in view of the latest incident, which was tragic. There is a good U.S. attorney in New York, and I have confidence that whatever decision is appropriate will be made as all the facts come out, and that's what's being done here. But I think that the focus ought to be everywhere on having the right kind of training and the right kind of policy direction to say that we're going to bring the crime rate down and we're going to bring the quality of police-community relations up. The two things are not inconsistent. In fact, I think generally they reinforce one another, and I think that that's what we all ought to be working for in New York and everywhere else in the country. Randy?
Mr. President, when you spoke with Russia's President-elect Putin the other day, what did he tell you to indicate how he might run the country, particularly in the areas of the economy and foreign policy? And do you think it would be a good idea for you or your successor to try to build the same sort of personal relationship with Putin that you had with Boris Yeltsin, in view of criticisms that U.S. policy was too focused on one individual?
Well, first, he has expressed a genuine commitment to economic reform, and the Russian economy is growing again, and a desire to put together a first-rate team, and that was encouraging. In foreign policy, he expressed an interest in working with us to pursue matters of mutual concern, particularly in the area of arms control and in some other areas, and I'm looking forward to working with him on that. With regard to the personal relations, I think that President Yeltsin, keep in mind, was the first democratically elected president of Russia, and he had the sort of a personality that was difficult not to, it was difficult to remain neutral in dealing with him. And I did like him very much, but I also thought he was committed to democracy, and I think the fact that he stepped down and that we had a genuine democratic transition in Russia is some evidence of that. So I think that regardless of personal chemistry, and I hope that mine with President Putin will be good, and I hope that my successors will be good with him, the United States and Russia have vast national interests that require them to work together on the things with which we agree and to manage the difficulties between us where we have honest disagreements. And so it is the relationship that is important. And the personal chemistry will come and go depending on the personalities. But the point is, the fact that I liked Boris Yeltsin didn't stop me from differing with him when we were differing, and it certainly never stopped him from differing with me in his classic style. And I don't expect that to change with President Putin, but I think that the relationship is very important to the United States and to Russia, and it must be worked on constantly. We just have too much in common, and we have to work on it. Yes, Ellen?
Electronic commerce, and they are giving some proposals. What are your thoughts about what proposals you think they should come out with, and also what about the states as electronic commerce becomes more and more available on the net and may take revenue from the states?
Well, I think, first of all, I supported the moratorium on taxes, and I saw where Mr. Gebhardt did as well a couple of days ago, and I think that's good. I think that we should. I think that the process that has been set up is the right one.